saving money on exterior wall lights. Now at Menards. Find your style with Patriot Lighting. Exterior lights enhance the look of your home. Choose from over 50 options from Patriot Lighting. Now through May 19th, get $10 instant savings on a single qualifying purchase of $100 or more on in-stock outdoor wall lights. Check out our entire selection of outdoor lights and see the rest of our deals happening now on Menards.com.
Save big money at Menards.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Have you heard you can listen to your favorite news podcasts ad-free? Good news. With Amazon Music, you have access to the largest catalog of ad-free top podcasts included with your Prime membership. To start listening, download the Amazon Music app or visit amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free and catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here today on the big program. Lots to get to, lots to talk about. Wow, what a day today was in the news from the UAW. There are another 8,700 workers taking to the picket lines in Kentucky. Look, you know, evidently Ford has not been moving, so they have now evidently. As of 6:30 today, gone and put another 8,700 UAW members on the picket line, and this is an escalation that you're gonna come to see as this continues. And look, nobody wants this. This isn't good for anyone. It's not good for Ford. It's not good for the UAW members. It's not. This is one of those things where you go, maybe get into a room, hammer it out, and get it done. Maybe just a thought. But as I said, 8,700 UAW members walked off the job today at 6:30 p.m. Eastern time in Louisville, Kentucky, at the Ford truck plant. And it's one of their most profitable. It's one of their most iconic plants. And again, this is that escalation that is going to happen as you see this stand-up strike continue. Our thoughts are with the workers as they take to the picket line. But this is going to continue. I had some great hope. I really did. I had some hope that this was going to get moving in a good direction, that things were going to smooth out, that there were some really good agreements that were happening, that there was some really good conversations, and, well, not so much. Now, I guess on Friday, Sean Fain will hold a Facebook Live, and there'll be more bargaining updates, and we'll get more out of that. But until then, this is what we know as of this moment. Sad to see. Again, this is another one of those moments where you look at these extraordinarily profitable companies, and it's not like they can't afford it. It's that they don't want to. That's the part that gets me. That's the part. Now, hey, good news. Good news. I got an email today. Told me I won a Ninja air fryer. Yeah, I won. Yeah, all I had to do was, you know, give them a whole bunch of information and do a whole bunch of things. And the reason I bring this up is, and this is kind of a public service announcement. There are so many scammers out there. If someone's asking you for your banking information, don't give it to them. If someone is asking you, and especially if someone's telling you, hey, go get gift cards to, oh, I don't know, a big box retailer, you know, to, you know, eBay Motors or any place like that, and then read us the numbers over the phone. Don't do that. And the reason I bring this up is I was at the bank today. We were we're planning our Christmas vacation, so we went to the bank, and there was an older guy, you know, an older guy. I mean, he was probably in his 80s. And I felt for him because he's talking to the teller, and the, you know, the teller is, you know, what caught my attention is the teller's like, oh, you know, just almost pleading, you know, that there's nothing we can do. I'm so sorry. And, you know, just, and so I started listening, and this poor guy, five grand, the guy was out in Lowe's gift cards that he evidently read the numbers over the phone. And the teller's like, hey, I'm sorry. You know, we gave you the money out of your account. Yeah. But there's literally nothing we can do once you give those numbers away. So, you know, here's the thing. If someone calls you and says, hey, a grandchild's been in trouble, go rush to the, you know, blah, 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 you know, anything, you know, Home Depot, Lowe's, you know, the local chicken place. I don't care. Anyone where there's a gift card. And go buy some gift cards and get us the money so we can help you get them out of jail or out of trouble or get them what they need. Don't do it. Call them first. You know, call somebody first. Because the scammers are out in huge ways. And it was heartbreaking because, you know, I felt for the teller. Because the teller, you know, I felt for the guy as well because he's out $5,000. But to be honest, if it's me, I'm going to spend $5,000 additional to make sure that nobody ever finds out that I got taken. But this poor guy, you know, who knows? Could have been his last $5,000 for all we know. And this is the kind of despicable treatment you see from these schemers and scammers. So please, by all means, don't do it. Let's start there. All right, so no speaker. No speaker again. World's in chaos. No speaker. Country's got problems. No speaker. Things got to get done. No speaker. A Republican Party who tells us they want to lead, no leader, no speaker, nothing. And what's interesting, even more so, I got to tell you, Donald Trump got kind of slapped today because his hand-chosen, hand-picked pit bull got shown the door. Jim Jordan is not going to be the speaker. Scalise got the votes, I guess, out of the powwow they had today. He's got to go to the full floor, which evidently he doesn't have the votes for. So we'll see what happens. But hey, you know, Trump's hand-picked candidate got shown the door, and I find that very interesting. But again, nothing today. We won't have a speaker. And I wonder if there'll be one tomorrow. Because look, if Scalise had the votes, it'd be done by now. If Scalise had enough votes to be speaker, it would be over because, look, the Republican Party's got to understand just how bad this looks, not just for the party, but for the country. You know, the fact that the Republican Party is so dysfunctional, so broken, and so incapable of, you know, policing themselves, of leading themselves, let alone the entire country, not just hurts us here at home, but hurts us around the world. And what I've found really interesting is all of the Fox News attacks, all of the you know, the Tim Scott attacks, all of the Republican attacks on Joe, this is Joe Biden's fault. No. This is the Republican Party's fault for showing the world that our country is dysfunctional. Our country is divided. Our country in this moment, because of the Republican Party, is weakened. We are viewed around the world as weakened because we can do nothing right now. We can literally do nothing. Stop and think about this for a second. We can do nothing. Nothing. There is no functional House of Representatives. Now, the president says that he wants aid for Taiwan, for Ukraine and Israel to be tied into one package. Well, good luck on that, because we don't have a house for that kind of an aid package to emanate from. Nothing. And there's part of me that goes, you know, I'm hoping that what happened in Israel and what's happening there now and all the chaos that's going on there, because understand, they're saying what I'm hearing is part of why it happened when it happened is, hello, total dysfunction here, our inability to respond. Thanks, House Republicans. Thanks, Tommy Tuberville. Thanks, GOP. Now, I was reading this story today that said, look, you know, as our members of the House were being briefed on what was going on, you know, the classified members-only briefing about what's going on over in Israel. They came out of the meeting. Clearly shaken were the words. Max Miller, a Republican from Ohio, evidently told some reporters that he learned something very, very new within the room that has changed the scope and how I see this developing situation. What does that mean? Does it mean now you're maybe going to do your job because you now realize that the globe is in peril, that our dysfunction is reverberating across the globe? Maybe, just a thought, that the Republican Party is so badly broken and so much of a cult that they are completely off the deep end. Because here's the other part. I love this today. This was my favorite story of the day. Because remember, the GOP is the constitutional party. They're the God-fearing constitution. Carry it in their pocket. Carried it around in their pocket. Evidently, our former president, Donald J. Trump's lawyers, argued to a judge in Colorado that it's not a requirement for the president to support the Constitution. No. No. Evidently, you know, the president's oath within the 14th Amendment, because they surely knew, requires the president to swear to preserve, protect, and defend, not to support. I don't know what that means. But again, this is that splitting hairs thing that I got to wonder, my Constitution friends, does this not make you kind of, I don't know, question your dear leader? Evidently, they claim the 14th Amendment never intended to apply to the president. The Constitution did not intend to apply to the president. This is their, I'm not making this up. This is their argument. These are the legal arguments they are taking into a courtroom and saying before a person in a robe with their hand on the book swearing to tell the truth. It's not the president's job to support the Constitution. And again, I've got questions. And I guess purely technically, when you know Trump put his hand on the Bible, and I think it was John Roberts who initiated the oath, it says preserve, protect, and defend. I don't know where support would fall in there, but I would think preserve, part of that, protect, sure, defend, all that, yeah, but not support. Huh. Interesting. But here's the thing. This falls right in the line with some of their other legal arguments, like, you know, I can't possibly inflate the cost of my properties because the Saudis will always bail me out. And the reason I think these two defenses are interesting, because I want my MAGA crowd. Please, MAGA world. Please, red hats. Tell me how that makes you feel. Do you have a problem with either of those defenses? Or is that's just him being smart? Is that Donald Trump being smart? Are these smart arguments? I gotta know. I gotta hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Got a lot to get to, a lot to talk about. Amazing stuff. Still, did I mention no speaker? Probably not going to have one tomorrow either. Quick break. Right back. Stick around.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So here's an interesting story. Evidently, Microsoft is evidently owes $29 billion in back taxes, according to the IRS. And look, this is one of those things we're going, please, it's about time the IRS start going after these big corporations and saying, hey, you owe us big money. How about time to, start paying up? Just a thought. Maybe it's time you start filling the coffers a bit. Now, this is evidently money that was hidden back before the Trump tax scheme. This goes back to, I think they said like 2003 to 2010. This is them trying to, and I think this is a good idea. You know, before Trump gave them amnesty and, you know, gave these corporations, you know, all of this ability to reshore all of the money they were hoarding overseas, maybe this is an opportunity to go back and get some of that. So it looks like, you know, with Microsoft underreporting all these U.S. profits, you know, for a decade, the IRS is going, hey, we're going to go back and get some of it. It's from 2003 to 2014 is what it was, and it's $28.9 billion. Plus penalties, plus interest. About time. And this is maybe this is how we fund the IRS agents we need to go after these big. You want to know why Republicans are against the extra IRS people? This is why, right here. Let's quick go to the phones. Got Alice on line one. Alice, what's on your mind?
A number of things, actually. So I'm reading WAPO and trying to keep up with everything that's going on. And I see the mess of, I want Jim Jordan, and I'm not voting for Scalise. And then there's the ones who want McCarthy,
yep.
And they're not going to vote for nobody else. And then it's just a mess. And, this is what I'm thinking, and I'm going to flat out tell you. I thoroughly believe that Putin, when he hacked into the Democrats' computers and got info, that we know that he hacked into the RNC. I believe that a number of them are being manipulated by Putin, and this is exactly what Putin wanted, because if we have a house in disarray, we can't do anything, and he and the rest of his little lunatics can go on about their merry way.
I gotta tell you, I can't argue with that, given the fact that the Republicans are spouting a lot of the same things that Putin's been spewing.
Exactly. And, you know, once you start putting everything together, then things start making sense. Just like if Iran would have gotten the info that Trump was running his mouth about, remember when he was telling people all the little secrets and he told this stuff about Israel? Well, you know, I'm sure that they would have shared it with their allies. So that plus Netanyahu, you know, I mean, he is not exactly smoothed the way there in Israel. And I'm going to say that because my stepdaughter is over in Israel. She has applied for citizenship because she's 1/8 Jewish. So I'm kind of worried about her, too. But, you know, the whole globe's burning, and we've got the clown show going on. But have a good evening,
Thanks,
Rick.
Thanks, Alice. Appreciate it. No, I mean, this is, you know, it's all part of the like you said, it's a clown show, sadly. But, you know what was interesting today, though? You know, Joe Biden doing the job, still doing his job, even with all of the craziness going on and the Republicans were attacking him. Because today, the FTC, the Federal Trade Commission, came out with their new measures to attack junk fees, the idea of eliminating junk fees. The new rule proposals by the Federal Trade Commission would ban fees across the U.S. economy. And they went through this whole thing, and I'm still looking into what the proposed new rules are. But I found it interesting that Republicans had some time today, you know, when they weren't primping and preening and, you know, not doing their job, to attack the president over this. And when I saw this, I'm going, you know, it's about time that the president or someone take on, you know, these companies that are just, you know, just killing you with fees. You know, and, you know, we're planning our vacation for Christmas. And, you know, we went online and we started looking at cruises and we started looking at all kinds of stuff. And it's amazing how, you know, the cost of something when they advertise it is this. But by the time you go through the whole, here's the final cost. It's like, it's more than double. And finally we scrapped the whole idea and went, you know, through AAA. Another example, you know, our anniversary is coming up, but I thought, hey, you know, it'd be a great idea to get concert tickets to a concert, you know, of someone my wife really likes a lot. I not so much. Not a big country music fan by any stretch of the imagination, but my wife enjoys it. So I'm like, you know what? It's our anniversary. Let's go look for tickets. And I found some. They're like $300 a piece, which are really expensive. And I'm like, oh, it's an anniversary, special occasion. I can justify it. So I go through this and I get to the end where you go to pay $90 per ticket in fees. 25%? Did I stutter? $90 per ticket in fees. And I said, this is crazy. And I said, you know what? Never mind. You know, I said, you know, as much as I love my wife, $90 in fees, I can't do it. We'll buy the album. We'll buy the album. We'll sit in the living room. I'll be miserable. She'll be happy. And she'll be able to hear the songs she actually likes instead of the ones that, you know, they're going to play that are probably somebody else's that she doesn't. But this is the kind of thing that is infuriating to me. Now, look, you know, you'd say, but, you know, Rick, you exercised your right in the free market to not participate. And yeah, I did. But the vast majority of people, sadly, are in a position where, you know, hey, yeah, it's just how it is. You can't fight City Hall. I got to eat this. And there's something wrong with that. And I guess maybe it's just that I'm a little older that I remember standing in line at the ticket booth and paying what the cost of the ticket was without all of the convenience fees and service fees and electronic transfer fees and fees because there's a fee and the fee for a fee and the fee for a fee's fee and whatever fee they can imagine up until you eventually get to $90 a ticket. And you wonder why, you know, these companies that produce nothing are so wildly profitable and why the working class is getting so screwed over. And I'm glad to see the president finally doing something on this front, somebody doing something. It's about time. So I'm curious, have you had one of these? I'd love to hear the horror stories of, you know, what's the most someone's had to pay in fees just to go see a game, to see a concert. I got to tell you, $90 was the most I've seen. When I saw that, I'm like, there is just no way I'm paying $300 for the ticket and then $90 on top of each ticket just for the right to buy the ticket from a website. Got to hear your thoughts. Is this how it should be? Is this the free market? Or am I just being an old guy who pines for the past of sitting overnight waiting in line? Quick break, right back. Stick around.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So the 2024 presidential race, well, shaping up. You've got RFK Jr. announcing his independent bid. You've got all the craziness on the right with that cabal of kookery. And now you've got Cenk Unger, who is running as a Democrat, going to give Joe Biden a challenge. And, you know, I got to tell you, I had a thought when I saw this announcement. Maybe he should stage an event with Alex Jones where Alex Jones pushes him down an escalator. That'd be a good idea. Now, here's the weird thing. Cenk, you cannot run for president because he's not a naturally born citizen. So for me, what is this? This is, you know, Cenk being Cenk. It's all about the attention. But we'll see. We'll see how this goes. And this is one of those situations where maybe you should not screw around because you might find out that you might get bitten. Anyway, here to share some thoughts on what is coming. And oh, did I mention we still don't have a speaker? I've asked our good friend Fred Wellman to come talk with us. Fred is a Democratic strategist, also the host of On Democracy with FP Wellman. You can find that where you find your podcasts. Fred, thanks for taking time for us.
Good to be back, brother. How are you, sir?
I'm good. So what do you think? Cenk running for president. What do you think there?
The stunt to get some marketing and, you know, the same thing. You know, the thing is, like you said, something clear. It's like, you know, Trump be fat and happy living in a Trump Tower, living large, if he hadn't ran for president. Now he's got 91 charges. His company's being dismantled in New York. I mean, if you want the attention, you'll get the attention. And Cenk wants attention. He lives for attention. So, of course, he can't run for president. And, of course, he's not going to take it to the Supreme Court because it's clear. I mean, the Supreme Court interprets the Constitution. Constitution's pretty clear on this. So, you know, it's just another stunt. Same thing with, you know, Robert Kennedy running was a stunt. Yeah, this is what they do. So, you know, whatever. But, you know, we've got serious things to worry about.
There are those out there who are pushing for a primary challenge for Biden. You got Romney. Mitt Romney's going to save the Democratic
I saw that.
Mitt's out there trying to find a Democratic challenger.
Biden's doing fine. Biden's numbers are great. You know, you see the resolute way he's leading us through this Israel crisis. You know, there's a lot of hand wringing. You know, I was at the Democrat National Committee's fall meeting in St. Louis, and I didn't see any hand wringing. You know, what I saw, you know, there wasn't any of the usual. As a matter of fact, I had an interview with Jamie Harrison about it, and nobody's wringing their hands. Or, you know, Biden's doing just fine. I mean, look, the key is I had Simon Rosenberg on my show the other day. He's the guy that predicted that the red wave would not be a red wave, right? And Simon brings up some really good points. I mean, everybody's freaking out about polls and stuff. But the fact is the Republicans are in the middle of a fairly relatively heated primary, thanks to DeSantis and all the other stuff. They're running against Trump. Trump's got all his criminal case. There's a lot of focus on politics on the Republican side. On the Democratic side, we don't really have a primary. We don't have – nothing's really going on. I'm talking to Democratic candidates around the country running for office. They're getting nervous because they're not raising money. But I keep telling them the Democratic electorate isn't energized yet. They're not engaged. It's still the first Iowa caucus is until January. We're just the election season hasn't kicked in the Democratic side yet. And when it does, you'll see a lot more interest and the numbers will be more realistic. But if you rely on polls right now and you've got half your electorate's not really paying attention, the other half is, it's going to be skewed, and they are skewed, and they're just as skewed as they've been in the past. So all this hand-wringing about polls or Biden being old, it's about results. And that's the last thing Simon always reminds me of, and I really enjoy talking to him about, is the fact is that for 40 elections since Dobbs, Democrats have overperformed now 12 points in every district they've been in. That doesn't even include Wisconsin. So, you know, people are going to wring their hands, but in the end, Joe Biden probably is going to be the nominee, and Joe Biden will do just fine.
I don't pay a lot of attention to the polls outside of,
yeah, it's a joke.
Outside of, you know, pointing out the fact that, you know, you can manipulate them any way you want. Yep. You know, it's what has been happening for a very long time. But here's the thing. I look at the fact that Did you know we don't have a Speaker of the House?
Yeah, isn't that hilarious? I mean, in the middle of a crisis, I actually did a whole video about it today. Is you know, one of the big Republican talking points, other than $6 billion, has been that this has been, all this is happening because we project weakness to the world. And I did an entire laundry list of, yeah, it's them. Exactly. You know, it's them. You know, it's the fact we don't have a Speaker. It's the fact that they almost shut the government down because they can't even agree amongst themselves. You know, the major party that runs the House of Representatives can't even govern. They're not interested in governing. The leader of their party is indicted 4 times, has 91 criminal charges. One of their members in good standing just had yet another 27 charges brought against him, and they haven't kicked him out. You know, and then, you know, you and I are old enough to remember when there used to be, kids probably don't know about this, but there used to be this thing called Rally Around the Flag. It's really a cute little thing we used to do back in the day, where when there was an international crisis or a national crisis, we put aside partisan politics to rally around our leaders and do the right thing for the world. And the Republican Party has trashed that and burned it to the ground because they've spent the last 3 days with Israelis and Americans, 22 Americans died. They've spent the last 3 days attacking Americans, attacking Biden, attacking our military with Tommy Tuberville's 3 holds. So look, you know, I take no stock of the Republican Party, and the only projection of weakness of the world is the fact that they know that one of our parties is completely beholden to Putin and completely beholden to nothing more than their own power structure. So I don't really give a damn what they think.
Tim Scott, running for president, wants to be president, saying Joe Biden's got blood on his hands. I mean, you know, to your point.
Disgusting. Just disgusting. Point,
exactly. I mean, you know, we used to say, you know, all of our fighting stopped at the water's edge. You know, much like you said, you know, when things happened on the international stage, we rallied around our president and showed a united front. Not anymore. And I got to wonder, you know, why that has changed in the Republican Party, because I'm old enough to remember, you know, Ronald Reagan didn't much care for the Russians. How is it now we've got a Republican Party spewing Russian talking points?
Well, it's because I think, you know, I mean, we could go on, we could do an entire week on that alone. But I think in a lot of ways, this they've given into a what is essentially a white nationalist viewpoint, whether that they didn't realize it, a Christian nationalist viewpoint. There is this myth in the Christian right, the far right, that Putin is somehow a knight of the Christian movement, that he has re-energized the right wing Christian movement, people don't really count that enough. How pervasive the belief is that Putin is the one man in Europe trying to fight for the blood, you know, fight for the Christianity, and you know he's taking the fight. So there's this weird, that weird part. The second weird part is this bizarre horniness they have for despots. You know, they just love the strongman. And then, you know, so I just think it goes on and on and on. And they love Putin. They love the idea that he's, you know, the tough guy. I mean, I just can't figure out. I live in Missouri, brother. I actually talked to a reporter today here, and none of us can understand why Josh Hawley is calling to defund support for Ukraine and send the support to Israel. He's literally and his excuse is that Hamas is an existential threat to Israel, whereas Putin has literally said he's going to completely eradicate the Ukraine state as a nation, and even, you know, inculcate their people into his people. You know, he's kidnapping children. It literally is. That's the definition of an existential threat to a nation, is the idea that it will be eliminated if it loses its war. And we've got a U.S. senator who lives in Virginia, not Missouri, saying we should, you know, let that happen. And I don't get it. I just don't get it. Although, again, I go back to remember, Josh is a hardcore Christian. He's all excited to, you know, have Israelis kill Muslims. But he wants to stop the fight with Putin. It's very suspicious to me. And I'd love to ask him a question about it, but he doesn't come to our state unless he's forced to.
He doesn't come to your state. But, you know, I saw that, and I've seen a lot of things out of Holly, like him going to a picket line.
Excuse me.
And I found that
my God.
Curious.
You should have heard about that. I got an earful about that one at some of the union members at the DNC. Because, you know, the DNC was hard. You know, obviously the energy at the DNC fall meeting for labor, the passion, the way that, I mean, the energy, Rick, for you as a labor guy, the energy that I heard from the labor representatives at the meeting, I sat in the labor caucus meeting. Bernie Sanders opened it with his classic Bernie telling it like it is, which makes him so funny. But the passion, I mean, because Biden went to the picket line, because he has said in no unwavering or uncertain terms that he, that the Democratic Party is the party of labor. It was really interesting. And so I think that was a game changer. So then to have Josh Hawley and J.D. Vance show up, I mean, to me, it's just a sign that he saw the polls. I think Josh is in trouble this time. I don't, you know, what's in trouble? I mean, it's Missouri. So he's maybe it's within 10 points, maybe. But if it's within 10 points, Josh is scared. Lucas Kuntz is coming on strong. He's learned his lessons from this first campaign. He's got a very capable campaign. He's got the same campaign team. So they've learned some good lessons. So they're running a very tight campaign. I think Hawley's getting the message that, you know, he's the most unpopular senator in the Senate. Which is amazing because there's Tuberville and Marsha Blackburn, but here we are. It's amazing what they'll do. The shamelessness and the lack of hypocrisy gene, you know. Well, I mean,
when the top of the ticket is Donald Trump,
there you go.
There's nothing down ticket that's going to be surprising.
Yeah. Shame has been removed as a gene in their bodies. That's for sure.
Which is why, you know, I look at, you know, Jim Jordan throwing his name into the ring to run for speaker. I mean, how does that guy with his history, knowing that all of the stories about his time as an assistant coach at Ohio State had to come out?
There's literally a documentary coming out.
Isn't
there a documentary coming out?
Which is why I think he did step back and eventually go, okay, I'm gonna support Scalise, because he had,
I don't know if he did. I don't know if he's done that, to be honest with you, Rick. I'm not sure that's actually occurring. I still always see that Nancy Mace is still up there saying she won't vote for him. She's gonna vote for Jordan. MTG is saying that.
Yeah, but you know, Nancy Mace also said there are Democrats who are gonna vote for Jordan.
Isn't she amazing? I mean, she is. I mean, every time there's just so many characters who are never cease to amaze me on the right. And Nancy's special because she's a special kind of nut job. And because they think she's normal and people try to like drag her out. I mean, I had a friend text me, a reporter again, text me like, why the heck is she on the media every night? You know, and it, cause she's just she's such a liar. I love seeing Jake Tapper's face. He just, or whoever it was just Chuck like Todd, Chuck Todd. Or no, it was, CNN. Anyway, he was just like, name one. name one Democrat that supports the trust Jim Jordan. Nobody trusts Jim Jordan. He's a crook. You know, I had a guest in the show, Dennis Aftergut. He's a former federal prosecutor. I got to get the clip. I got to run the clip. And he said, it was when Jim Jordan started his antics about 8 months ago, and he's, or 6 months ago. And he said, you know, Jim Jordan has one move. His brand is simple. His brand is faceplant. And Jim Jordan is one long face plant. So it's pretty entertaining to see him try and act like it. But again, the same thing with Scalise. Scalise has stepped up now. People are going to start going through his record. If you decide to go from, you know, just being a member of the caucus, even the number two, I don't think these guys realize the media scrutiny that will go with stepping up. And so I'm looking forward to every speech. Like already my friends at Midas Touch, where, you know, my show is broadcast on the Midas Touch Network. Midas Touch is already going through where in 2012, he said that Social Security, Medicaid, and Medicare needed to be cut if we were going to try and balance the budget. They're already going through and finding his speeches he gave at white nationalist conferences. These guys have lived in a bubble, being told how awesome they are for so long. They're not ready for the exposure that's going to go with being a national figure. So I say, welcome to the party, fellas. We're here for you. No, and people like you and me, we're going to call them out.
No, absolutely. And I wanted Trump as speaker. I still want Trump as speaker.
Oh my God, that would be amazing. Cause it actually has to, there actually work that has to occur. And Trump's never done a day of work in his life.
Such truth is spoken right there. So on the speaker front, cause at some point there has to be one.
Yeah. Or does, well, there? In theory. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, look, I think I've been calling it the temporary speaker. Jamie Harrison said it great, because, you know, when they took over the house, it's just an Airbnb, it's just a long term rental, because they're not going to hold the house long. The fact is, I think it'll probably be Scalise, and it'll be a disaster. It's not uniting. They cannot unite their caucus. Nothing is going to change as far as their ability to actually pass an agenda. I have no idea if he'll be able to legislate and work with the Senate. I don't know if he's had any interest. I think maybe he'll be held hostage by his caucus as much as McCarthy was. Yeah. I believe in my heart that what the number one thing that Matt Gaetz and his renegades did is assure that the Democrats will take over the House.
And I think that was on purpose. And I got to tell you, maybe you'll disagree, but I think it was on purpose because I don't think Republicans want to be in the majority. I think
governing is hard.
Throwers. I think they want to stay as the the whiners, the complainers, the finger pointers. I think that's who they want to be. They don't have an agenda. Yep. They've got no policy initiatives. They've got no vision, no ideas. So it's easy to be the party of no, especially when you're not the one leading the show.
Right, right. Which is why it's so funny to see the Democrats do such a brilliant job under Hakeem Jeffries, just doing exactly that. But dismantling them at every turn, and not, they're not able to govern. And I said it when they took it. I wrote a piece. I think I just one of my videos, and I said, look, in a lot of ways, the Republicans are taking the House with such a slim majority is a great opportunity for us who are pundits, if you will, or super PACs, to show exactly what Republican-controlled government will look like. And this is the message I want them to use in Virginia. Hey, look, I talked to Jamie about this on the show. I was like, look, if you want to see how it's going to be, if we give the Republicans a unified government in Virginia, this is just look at the House. Look at what's going on in the House. They can't even get along themselves. We had the same thing here in Missouri, where they've been a supermajority for 20 years. They can't even, the Democrats get stuff done because the Republicans all hate each other so much. They have to work with Dems to pass anything because they all hate each other. And so it is really a great way for us to demonstrate exactly what happens by giving Republicans power. And I tell you, I hope groups like my former friends, my former colleagues at Lincoln Project, and I know we at the Midas Touch Network, which is not a PAC anymore, but a network, and I think all the big super PACs are out there, we're going to be pounding that message. Like, do you really want to give these guys power? And just running on repeat all the cartoonish stupidity that they've done for the last year and a half. I don't know. I mean, the ads write themselves.
Oh, no, the comedy skit is what it is. But sadly,
it is
the fact that they're as dysfunctional as they are. Not only shows weakness at home, but abroad as well. Yeah. And nothing.
Well, that's it.
Nothing good comes out of that. And you as a former military guy, you know, as well as anyone, that's not a good environment on the international stage to have this kind of dysfunction at home.
And it's a long-term impact. Let's just take the military part of it, right? Take my veteran status. I got my 101st patch here behind me on the wall. This is long-term damage they're doing. I am talking to actual colleagues who have people still in the army, we're in the army still, or have friends in the army. And consistently we're hearing from mid-grade officers, guys with lieutenant colonels, like I wasn't retired. They're like, this isn't worth it. This is just the start. Tuberville and the attacks on Milley, the attacks on wokeness by all these Republicans, they have politicized the military in a way we haven't seen ever. And that, well, actually, frankly, since McCarthy, we haven't seen it since the first McCarthy, when they politicized the communist hunt. And that has long-term damage. You could make a case that one of the reasons we struggled in Vietnam was because it was 20 years after the McCarthy hearings, or 10 to 15 years, and that's because all the good people got out, because generals aren't made overnight. Generals take, I mean, my God, Milley was in the army 43 years, okay? The leaders of tomorrow are the junior and mid-grade leaders of today. And they're watching this debacle, seeing what their seniors are going through and saying, you know what? It ain't worth this smoke. I can get a job in the real world where unemployment's like 0% right now, which means, I can get a job and I'll be fine. And I'll get paid a bunch of money to go work on Wall Street or somewhere else. And guess what? I don't have to deal with these idiots. And the problem with that is the long-term impact is that when we have a war in 20 years, only the clowns stay behind. Okay, the MAGA chuds, or the people who were scared of getting out because they know they're not gonna be able to get a job in the real world. And those clowns will be the leaders of tomorrow. We're gonna be in trouble. So the impact on the military isn't just today. It's a long-term impact that could affect our national security for years to come. That's what scares guys like me who are career Army military officers. We know that Tuberville's little cute little antics right now is gonna destroy the military, not just for now, but for years and years to come. And that's why I hate him with the heat of a thousand suns.
As we all should. Last question. Who's going to be speaker? Any thoughts?
I think they'll get their stuff together and end up being Scalise. It's going to take him about 4 or 5 days. He's going to make a bunch of deals like McCarthy did. And they'll end up having a very hobbled speaker. Marjorie Taylor Greene and everybody else will get some deals. George Santos will cut a deal not to get kicked out of Congress till he's convicted. But it'll probably squeeze. It'll probably be next week though. And we'll be right back where we were with McCarthy, a speaker owned by the MAGA minority and a House incapable of actually governing.
Well, fortunately, nothing was going to get done anyway. So
yeah, it works out well. I mean, the good news is they can't pass their stupid ideas either. So, you know, I guess that's a positive.
That is a positive. Fred, I appreciate the time as always. Great stuff.
Always,
appreciate the time. Hope folks will check out the podcast on Democracy with FP Wellman. We'll get links out on social media. Appreciate it, man.
Always good, brother. Talk to you soon.
Thanks so much, Fred. I'm going to take a quick break. Right back with your thoughts. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1874. That was the day that Mary Heaton Vorse was born in New York City. Mary grew up in Amherst, Massachusetts, in a family with significant financial means. She traveled across Europe with her parents, where she received her education and learned to speak multiple languages fluently. She then worked as a book reviewer for the Criterion magazine. In 1912, Mary and the man who would be her husband witnessed what would be known as the Bread and Roses textile strike in Lawrence, Massachusetts. The experience was a great turning point in her life. She later wrote, "Both Joe O'Brien and I had come a long road to get to Lawrence. Together, we experienced the realization of the human cost of our industrial life. Something transforming happened to both of us. We knew now where we belonged. On the side of the workers and not with the comfortable people among whom we were born. Some synthesis had taken place between my life and that of the workers. Some peculiar change that would never again permit me to look with indifference on the fact that riches for the few were made by misery of the many. It was in Lawrence that we realized what we must do, that we could make one contribution, that of writing the workers' story as long as we lived." For more than 50 years after Lawrence, Mary traveled the United States reporting and participating in strikes and the labor movement. She wrote about the 1919 steel strike and the lumber workers' strike in the Pacific Northwest. She wrote about the struggles of auto workers and textile workers and child labor. In 1962, the United Auto Workers honored Mary with their Social Justice Award. Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
So the lectern gate continues in Arkansas. Evidently this is still a thing. You know, it's still a thing. Evidently, a citizen journalist has unearthed an email that points out that someone in Sarah Huckabee Sanders' office instructed state employees to write "to be reimbursed" on a month's old invoice for the $19,000 lectern, and specifically told them not to date the notation. I'm still confused on why $19,000 for a lectern, but this has still got legs. What didn't get a lot of attention is the voucher money in Arkansas, and it's been a year. They have released the first year voucher report, where they say, you know, about 4,800 students participated in the first semester of the new K-12 voucher program. And what they found, it went to mostly religious private schools. It went to mostly people whose kids were already going to private schools, a windfall to the folks who were already there. The state of Arkansas had allocated about $46.7 million in state funds for the voucher program. But the report said that they're going to only expend about $32.5 million over the first year. So far, $7 million has been spent. And as I said, most of that into the hands of, people who are already sending their kids to the private schools. Now, what you're going to see, and this is not going to be shocking, not going to be surprising, it's what it's supposed to do. Every mega church will have a school attached so that they can get state funding, so that they can get their hands into the taxpayers' pocket, get their nose into the taxpayers' trough, and load up. This is the future of education. Incorporate it. Not really about teaching your kids. It's about the money. So get ready for that, because vouchers are here. This is the latest silver bullet. This is where the big money is pushing. So I expect it to come to my neck of the woods very soon, as there's a crazy group of people running for school board here with a whole bunch of right-wing money behind them, you know, pushing this idea that, you know, well, you know, the public schools are a failure. You know, vouchers and all the schemes are not far behind. You know, it's coming. And, you know, I just had one of these conversations the other day with someone who said, you know, I've heard, you know, all of these things. You know, I've heard these private schools are so much better. Yeah, some of the private schools are so much better. The elite ones are. The ones where parents are hyper-involved. But you know what? Kids in public school whose parents are hyper-involved, they do well, too. But I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. Are you surprised? First year, money went to people who were already sending their kids. I think we predicted that, if you remember, a year ago when Sarah signed that. I think that was the prediction.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So for years here on the program, we've been talking about the economy and how the economy doesn't work for working people. The game seems to be rigged for the wealthy and the well-connected. And recently we've been talking about how inequality is, well, right up there in the Gilded Age levels. And while we can and do spend considerable time talking about all of the problems and pointing out all the problems, I like to talk about the fixes. Is there a way to fix our problems? Is there a way to make things better for working people? Now, personally, I advocate for higher taxes on billionaires. In fact, I don't think we should have any. I agree with Sean Fain. We should eat the rich. We need stronger unions to help workers fight for better wages, hours, and conditions. And, of course, I think we need stronger regulations. Break up these big monopolies. Level the playing field for average, everyday, working-class Americans. But is that enough? Could we do more? Should we do more? Well, here to help us work through some of that is Marjorie Kelly. Marjorie is a distinguished senior fellow at the Democracy Collaborative. They've got a new book out, Wealth Supremacy: How the Extractive Economy and Biased Rules of Capitalism Drive Today's Crisis. One of the must reads for anyone who wants to think about how we make a better economy for working people. Marjorie, thanks for taking time for us.
Rick, thanks for having me. It's a treat to be here.
So, look, let's start at this space. You know, I think, you know, I look to the FDR era. I look to the New Deal era of, hey, you know, we need stronger labor unions. We need better rules. We need higher taxes on rich people to kind of level out the game. Is that enough? Is that our grandparents' economy? What do we do?
Yeah, you said it right there. That's our grandparents' economy. What you're talking about is all the rules, you know, from the 30s and that era of how to regulate capitalism. But it, you know, it's worse today, right? I mean, wages have been stagnant. There's this incredible war on workers. 40% of jobs are now insecure. They're contingent, part-time, gig, and it's going to get worse with artificial intelligence. So, you know, it's hard to unionize somebody when they're subcontracted, and then there's a temp agency that, you know, is hiring, going to the subcontractor. Capital interests have succeeded in really decimating worker power. And, you know, we need to climb into the driver's seat, Rick. This is what I'm pointing out here in Wealth Supremacy, is that, you know, here's a weirdness of our economy. Workers are not considered members of the corporation. Only capital has a vote inside the corporation. They vote for the CEO. CEO gets paid. CEO gets rich if shareholders get rich. Well, you know, shareholders don't go and do the work of the company. If a worker goes there every day for 30 years, they're not a member of that corporation, but an algorithm holding stock for 10 minutes does have a vote and is a member. So that's crazy. So we need to be talking about worker ownership. We need to be talking about, you know, corporations that are designed to serve workers and the community, and not just designed to serve capital. I mean, that, we need to really move beyond the system as it is right now.
But, you know, some would say, well, now you're talking about socialism. You're talking about worker-owned collaboratives, which we've tried it on small scales. And, you know, there have been, you know, attempts across the globe at this, you know, that end up getting crushed by big capital interest. How do we get to that place? You know, look, I'm not against it. I think it'd be a great idea to own the factors of production as a working person, as opposed to just being a negative on a balance sheet. So how do we get to that place?
Well, so let me say two things. First of all, worker ownership, it does work. I mean, Recology is a $1 billion company. It's a waste hauling recycling company in San Francisco. It's 100% owned by workers. Garbage truck drivers make more than $100,000 a year, right? So worker ownership can work at large scale. We also need public ownership of water. And California is looking at public ownership of pharmaceuticals, you know, be doing insulin. So yes, there can be other forms of ownership rather than just having a big capital own it all. But here's the other thing, and that's really important. This is important, Rick, and that is that we have to see that the current system is not legitimate. I mean, we can come up with all of these little gimmicks of how to get from here to there, but until we see that really there's a bias at work here, and this is what I mean by wealth supremacy. The system is biased toward the wealthy and toward capital. And I unpack how that is in very granular ways. This is not hand waving. You can look at the structure of the income statement and corporate governance and accounting rules. And I unpack these in a very accessible way and show you feel like it is rigged. It is rigged. And there are other ways that work that we can move toward.
No, and this is where I keep coming back to, you know, I go back to my grandparents' tax code. I go back to the, you know, the good socialist president, Dwight David Eisenhower's tax code of, you know, top marginal rate of 92% and a corporate rate of 56%. Once you have rates like that, you don't have gazillionaires anymore. You have a more distributed income. You have more shared wealth, I think, because it's forced by a government entity saying we're gonna make sure wealth is distributed in a way that's a little bit more fair. I mean, we had rich people, but we didn't have the kind of gazillionaires we've got today.
No, you know, here's a couple of facts that really struck me lately. All of the developing nations in the world, they're struggling with their debt right now. And their rich people and institutional investors own that debt, right? Debt is owed to somebody. So $300 billion is what Bill Gates has in his personal wealth, $300 billion with a B. And if you took all of the developing nations' debt, it amounts to $200 billion. So this one person could theoretically wipe out all of the debt of these struggling companies, and he would still have $100 billion, which is more money than any of us can even, we sure. can't even count that high. This is how out of whack it's gotten. It's absurd. And here's the other thing. The way that the rules are written right now, corporations have an obligation to maximize the gains of Bill Gates and other capital owners. You know, until we change that, Rick, we're attacking a mountain with teaspoons. I don't think we have recognized how serious the problem is and that we need to move beyond this. And let me give you just a quick example of how we could do that. If we got serious about it, Elizabeth Warren has said the Accountable Capitalism Act, every corporation over $1 billion, they need a new federal charter, which says you have to serve the public good. You're not just serving shareholders anymore. And 40% of board seats are reserved for workers. Now that would start to be a different kind of game. And that's an example of the kind of thing that we need.
No, I'm all in favor of that. I think that is a great idea. You know, but I also come back to that tax thing,
Yeah,
because I think that's important in that, you know, think of the Gilded Age. You know, who were the robber barons of the Gilded Age? You know, you could name a bunch of them, couldn't you?
Oh, sure. Rockefeller, Carnegie. Yeah. Taxing is important. There's no one silver bullet. I don't want to give that impression, but we need an economy that's designed for all of us to thrive and for to have a living ecology at the same time. But you're right. I think taxation is absolutely critical. We need inheritance taxes. We probably need transaction taxes. Slow down some of this, you know, ridiculous investment trading that's going on. You're absolutely right. We shouldn't have billionaires, and you shouldn't have, you know, children inheriting this obscene wealth. I mean, some inheritance is fine, but right, we don't want dynasties.
No, because my point is, you know, you can name a whole bunch of our billionaires today. You've got Musk and you got Bezos and you got all of them. You know, you can't name a bunch of them from the 1950s because we didn't have a whole bunch of them. And what's frustrating to me is we've been told that the benevolence, the philanthropy of our billionaire class will solve some of our problems. Well, they haven't. As you've pointed out, Bill Gates could solve problems. He could leave a legacy of being of someone who eradicated, you know, debt to foreign countries. You know, Jeff Bezos could end child poverty. You could get Elon Musk, who could end homelessness. We could end problems with the kind of wealth that these people have. They just choose not to because benevolence doesn't work.
Well, that's right. And so, you know, we need to look at, well, what's the system that creates that wealth? And actually, what I would say, the system that extracts that wealth is more accurate. It's not really creating wealth for the most part. It's extracting it from the rest of us. I mean, look at, for example, these big tech companies, you know, Google and Facebook and so on. When they hit a downturn not too long ago, what's the first thing that they did? Their stock turned down. They threw thousands of workers out of work. That was the very first thing they did, because that fattens the bottom line, and the bottom line determines your share price. So it's a direct transfer of wealth. And so we need to look at that system, Rick, and we need to say, no, we can't have this system anymore. We can still have corporations, we can still have investments, and of course we need better tax system, but we can move to a different kind of system, and I think it's high time.
And I think we can return to a production-based economy instead of a paper-shuffling economy, a Wall Street economy. I want a factory town. I want a small town America that has a Main Street. I'm tired of the Wall Street economy that's been screwing over working people for the last couple of generations.
Yeah, I think that's right. There's been a concerted war on workers, and it's a war by capital to fatten its own coffers by degrading workers. And we need to see that as a unified phenomenon that it is. You know, when you're sending jobs overseas, or you're laying people off, or you're creating gig jobs that are no longer full-time work, all of that is part of the war on workers. And, you know, unions, it should be, if you want to join a union, it should be as easy to join a union as it is to join a mutual fund, right? If you want it, you should be able to have it. And it's crazy. It's absolutely crazy that companies fight unions. The right to join a union is a universal human right. This was recognized back in 1948. They shouldn't be fighting universal human rights. That's crazy.
This for me comes back down to a legislative agenda that I would hope working people would get on board with. The ability to join and form unions should be as easy as it was when my grandparents were in the heart of their working lives. A sane and rational tax code where the bigger your shoulders, the more water you carry, the more society expects, because the more you take away from, the more you extract from the economy, the more is expected of you. I mean, some common sense truths of the past, but updated for the future, because you're right. Our economy has changed a bit because we do have more gig workers. But, you know, we had them back, you know, 100 years ago, too. And we made laws to be able to ensure that we protected people. I think we can do that again.
Well, we certainly need to find a lot of ways to do it again, Rick. And I would love to see workers get have a voice in the boardroom, too. I think that's the kind of power that we need to be ultimately heading for.
Without question. You know, and I absolutely like they have in Germany, where you have workers on the board who are making decisions for the working people as well. Absolutely. The book Wealth Supremacy, right. How the Extractive Economy and Biased Rules of Capitalism Drives Today's Crisis by Marjorie Kelly. We'll get links out on social media. How you can take a look at this. What kind of response you've been getting to this? I mean, you know, when you're talking about some pretty radical stuff here, and I'm sure the socialism word's been thrown at you. How dare you talk about socialism?
Oh, yeah. You know, first of all, I reject the idea that our choices are binary. That's either capitalism or socialism. I think that we need something that's beyond those. Both of those are like 150 years old. So you said, how's it being received? Very well. There's a lot of interest. I mean, we had a launch event at the Aspen Institute in Washington, D.C. We had 600 people sign up. You know, that's that's not a radical organization. And yet they really saw merit in these arguments and this idea of system change. So, Rick, I think we're in different times. I think we're going to start to see rising interest in system change and getting serious about building economy for the rest of us.
Because look, I think, you know, what built the most prosperous class, working class in the history of civilization during my grandparents' generation was brought about because literally workers were ripping this country apart brick by brick. I mean, there were strikes all over. There were sit-down strikes. There was chaos in this country. The National Labor Relations Act was a peace treaty to get workers to stop striking and causing chaos. And you're seeing workers back in the streets like we haven't seen in generations. So, you know, right now, a conversation on how we restructure an economy to ensure that working people get a fair share of the wealth that their labor creates probably could be received by folks in the corporate boardroom, because I don't know that they want to see their heads on platters, or, you know, as the Sean Fain T-shirt said, I don't think they want to be eaten.
I'm hopeful that the time is right for a deeper kind of conversation. Unions are needed, you know, absolutely. And we need even more fundamental power. We need to own companies. We need to have a seat in the boardroom. And like you said, we need to tax away the wealth of these absurd billionaires. I think we can get there, Rick. I think if we work together and start to have conversations like this, I think people are ready.
Yeah, but it all comes back down to politics, doesn't it?
Well, it does. But it's also true that you need to build the models that work. And a lot of that work is happening in the private sector. In fact, you know, impact investors are real players in this too. So it's not only policy that drives this. There's a huge movement for impact investing for racial equity and for ecological sustainability and for worker gains. I mean, investors can, there's money to be made as an investor in converting existing companies to worker ownership. There's some really exciting models that are happening in that arena. And you could have federal policies that support that and accelerate that kind of movement.
Well, I got to tell you, I'm excited about the potential of a positive future and changes that you talk about in this book. I hope folks will take a look at it. It's called Wealth Supremacy, How the Extractive Economy and Biased Rules of Capitalism Drive Today's Crisis by Marjorie Kelly. She is a distinguished senior fellow over at the Democracy Collaborative. We'll get links out on social media. How you can take a look at the book. Marjorie, as always, I appreciate you taking some time. I hope you'll come back and talk to us again real soon.
Let's do it, Rick. Thanks so much for having me.
Outstanding stuff. Again, Wealth Supremacy. We'll get links out on how you can take a look at the book. Highly, highly suggest it. Gotta take a quick break. Right back with your thoughts. Stick around and listen to the Rick Smith Show. More working people. Talk.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
I gotta tell you, no, I'm all on board with the idea of worker-owned collaboratives. I'm all on board with the idea of workers owning the factors of production and having a say on the job. I'm just not seeing it happening on a large enough scale to compete with these big corporate interests, especially now as you're seeing, you know, these hedge funds and all of these groups that are just, you know, just raising obscene amounts of money. I mean, seriously, just obscene amounts of money, buying up housing, buying up everything they can. And this is where it comes back to. We need to have some bit of, some bit of regulatory oversight to make sure that we don't have the kind of monopolization that we've been seeing. Just a thought. We'll see. Let's go to the phones. We got John on line one from Madison. John, how are you?
Hey, I'm well. How you doing?
Good. What's on your mind, brother?
Yeah, I was just listening here, and I'm really not familiar with your show, but I heard you talk about gazillionaires, and I just was, I'm thinking the problem here is more with inflation. And I'm looking up Henry Ford's wealth adjusted for inflation, and he possessed $200 billion in today's valuing. So
and when was Henry
the problem
Ford?
Problem is not necessarily, these gazillionaires, it's the printing press and the inflation. And the solution for that is Bitcoin, quite honestly, because it's capped at 21 million coins.
Yeah, and I'm not going there with
distributed.
You.
Well, I already went there.
Okay. Congratulations.
I'm living there.
All right.
Huh?
Good. Is
so
it working
I'm just
for
saying,
you?
I mean, either way, yeah, it is. And either way, Good. We have to address the inflation and the printing press. That is the problem. You know, politics, I don't think, is going to solve the problem. Socialism or capitalism, you know, we've experimented with those for quite a while. And I'm not sure if I was cut off, but yeah, I really believe Bitcoin is a solution. I encourage everybody to just give it a fair look.
All right. Good stuff. You got your ad in. Thanks,
okay.
John.
Thanks a lot.
Appreciate it. I'm not a digital coin guy, but yeah, some people are. I've had some people who say they did really well. I've had some people who say they lost their shirt. That's up to you. Now, Henry Ford, you go, okay, well, Henry Ford was his wealth created before a lot of the taxation. And to my point, you know, name the Gilded Age billionaires. You know, name those billionaires from the teens and before. You can name a bunch of them, can't you? Then you go into the 50s and the 60s. You know, who were they? There weren't those kind of extreme wealth individuals, because we taxed them. And we took that money and we invested in infrastructure. We paid for our wars. We invested in communities. We invested in building this country. And oh, by the way, corporations paid workers. You know, part of the whole giving massive tax breaks to corporations, it just meant that they put more money in their pockets, as opposed to going, no, I don't want to give it to the government. We're going to pay higher wages. And oh, by the way, we had stronger unions back then to demand higher wages. That was a huge part of this as well. So in looking where we are and where we're heading, for the working people of this country, wages have been stagnant for a couple of decades. You know, what, five now? So in looking at Marjorie's book, the hope is that there is a way forward to make work pay, to have a reward for work. Or, you know, I love hearing my Republican friends say, nobody wants to work anymore. I hear this a lot. Nobody wants to work anymore. Well, nobody wants to work for poverty wages in desperate conditions. And, you know, I go back to that Timothy Gurney guy who said, you know, we need massive unemployment. We need to get those working people back into line, because they like a desperation economy. And my fear is, as we move to the AI and the robotics and all this stuff, that we're so far behind that they get their wish, because we've done nothing to address what's coming. Nothing. So we'll see. We'll see where this goes. But again, the book, if you want to take a look at it, Wealth Supremacy, How the Extractive Economy and Biased Rules of Capitalism Drive Today's Crisis. We'll get links out on social media. You can take a look at that. Written by Marjorie Kelly over at the Democracy Collaborative. Got lots more to get to. You miss any portion of the program, make sure you grab the podcast. Wherever you find your favorite podcast, you'll find ours. If you got something that I said got on your under your skin, on your nerves, under your mind, or just made you think, I want to hear it. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. I'll take a quick break right back after this. Stick around.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So today there was a massive crowd of working people out in the streets in New York City at the site of the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire Memorial. There was a dedication today as workers remembered the 1911 fire that killed more than, killed 146 working people, mostly women, mostly immigrants, young women. Many who jumped to their deaths because, the factory owner didn't want them stealing little scraps. You don't want that happening. Don't want your scraps stolen. So they locked the exit doors so that when the fire broke out, no way to get out. And again, this is one of those tragedies of the past where you go, this is how we got the regulations that we have in place today. The people who died for the regulations that we kind of not just take for granted, but end up in a lot of cases, you hear people mocking or somehow, being angry over. But you had, thousands of people out in the streets today. And this is a big deal. And I've been to the building that the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire happened. It's now a... it's a science building, I think, for NYU in downtown New York City. And when we did our people's tour back in, I think it was 2013, we ended up going through and taking a tour of the building and looking down. And it's one of those things where, as I'm looking down, to the ground and all the way, from the 7th and 8th floor, looking down and then imagining there being this burning fire that you cannot escape from, this just horrible situation that you can't get away from because you're locked in, you are trapped. Your only options are you're going to burn to death or you're going to jump to your death. Imagine putting yourself in that situation. Imagine how horrible that is. But like I said, today there was a dedication, a memorial for those 146 workers who perished because of this. And here to share some thoughts on the day's events and share some thoughts on what it took to get to this, because this was no small feat. I've asked Suzanne Pred-Bass to come talk with us. She is a board member of the Remember the Triangle Fire Coalition. She's the great niece of Rosie Wiener, who died in the Triangle Factory Fire, and also Kate Wiener, who was one of the folks who did get out. Suzanne, thanks for taking time for us.
I'm really happy to be here.
So tell me about today's event. I saw video. I saw some of the speeches. I saw people, talking. I talked to somebody who was there. This was an impressive event, wasn't it?
It was extraordinary. This was 12 years in the making, Rick. We began the idea of this memorial 12 years ago. We had a huge international competition with over 180 designs submitted. a panel jury of top people in the field, and then raised money like crazy, and you know, went through city bureaucracy nightmares in order to get permissions and pass through landmarks. And I mean, you know, you have an idea of what it takes. And now there is on the Brown Building, which is the building that the fire took place in. It is owned by NYU, and they allowed us to put it on this building. It used to be called the Ash Building, you know. How about that for a pun? A-S-C-H spelt. But it's stunning. I wish you could just jump over and see it. It's got two panels. It's got names cut out that are reflected down. You can't imagine. When it was described to me, I wasn't sure, how is that going to work? But these names are reflected down on a lower panel that has quotes from people who were at the actual fire. And, you know, then you've got all the names and the ages translations in Yiddish and Italian, because those were the languages of these young, mostly immigrant women workers. And, you know, it's just phenomenal, you know. And today there was huge crowd there. I understand about 2,000. Yeah. I wasn't counting. I was too busy doing other stuff. But, you know, they lined up and, you know, went carefully around, and people were incredibly moved by it. It's stunning. It is changing the landscape of New York City.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing it. Because I've been to the Brown Building. You know, back in 13, we did a labor history tour, and one of the places we stopped was with the building, and they were nice enough to allow us to go through the area that had been, you know, where the fire was, and, you know, gave us a, you know, kind of a halfway guided tour, if you will. And, you know, the floor where most of the people unfortunately perished is now like a science lab, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, it's a little eerie because, you know, it's got the same long tables, you know, that they had in the factory, only this time they're sort of labs with microscopes and, you know, little, you know, desks for people to work on, but the same long tables row after row that had sewing machines in 1911.
So, you know, this has been, you know, the legacy of your family for, you know, for your lifetime. What has this meant to you over your lifetime, and what does this dedication and this monument mean to you now?
You know, my daughter said to me, and I'm so fortunate because, you know, I've been able to do many, many terrific and satisfying things in my life. But she said, "Mom, this is your life's work." And I do feel like I carry a mantle for my family, particularly my great aunts, my great grandmother, my mother, that whole generation that suffered this, you know, cataclysmic tragedy, this unexpected, unfathomable, unnecessary loss of lives, that traumatized them, you know, for the rest of their lives. My mother, at the age of 4, was taken by her mother to what was called the Charity Piers to identify Rosie's body. Now, you can imagine what that did to a 4-year-old, hearing the shrieks, seeing the charred bodies. She never forgot, and she carried that. And, you know, I just am so filled with gratitude that I was able to be part of this process of this amazing group, the Triangle, Remember the Triangle Fire Coalition board, who have worked relentlessly and with such dedication to make this happen. And I really feel like I spoke today at the ceremony, and I quoted from a union report, because even though these louses, I'll call them that, would not allow the shop to become a union shop. Many of these young workers were union workers. So there was actually a union visit to my family's house after Rosie died. And my great-grandmother said, you know, that Rosie had saved $400 in, I don't know how many years, probably 5-6 years of work. So you figure 50 cents to a dollar a week she was sometimes putting away. And it was, I know from other sources that Rosie wanted to move out of the city and have a farm. But her mother said, this has to go for a monument for her. And here I am and we are finally building this monument that even back then, I mean, she didn't have this vision, but she had a longing for it.
Yeah. And also, you know, so that no one forgets about it and that we learn the lessons of history and never allow it to happen again.
Yeah, well, would that would be the case. You know, we had people from Turkey, Cambodia, Bangladesh who came to this today. And, you know, there are workers all through those countries in South America, and we can find them in our own country, that are working in intolerable, unsafe, fire trap conditions and locked in, you know, the same circumstances. But yes, this is a vibrant, powerful call to people to remember and also to be inspired to look to what our labor history is and what we must not repeat.
You know, back in 2013, we did a cross-country labor history tour. And we went, you know, all the way out to California, up to Washington and back again. We did 9,800 miles in 30 days, seeking out labor's history, wrote a book out of it, did all kinds of stuff. And the one thing that remained constant is in places where labor's history was, where it was allowed to be, it was sanitized with corporate speak in a lot of places, or it was eviscerated entirely. We went to Blair Mountain, where the Battle of Blair Mountain happened, and they literally removed all of the history, brick by brick, every building, every road, everything. They even wanted to remove the mountain. So to have a bit of history where there's labor is behind it, I think is so very important, especially in something on a tragedy that is this important.
Yeah. You know, it was the biggest workplace tragedy in American history until 9/11. So it was huge. And, you know, had you been there today, all the SAG-AFTRA workers were told not to be on picket lines. They were told to go there to the ceremony today. And there were union people just, you know, by the hundreds there, and so many young people. And they are the ones that this is speaking to. And that is crucial.
So last question I've got for you. Obviously, as we've been saying, this has been your life's work. This has been your family legacy. What do you hope people take from this? What do you hope the future holds for this? What's your vision for what people take from it?
Well, you know, it's twofold. People have to be moved by the enormity of this tragedy, by the loss of these young lives, you know, left their houses one morning and never returned. And they were and speak to so many of the issues that we still, like I've said, are relevant today. It's immigrant issues, it's women issues, it's laborer issues, it's safety issues, you know, so many things. And I hope, you know, people, come away with the sense that, like you said, we can't let anything like this happen again. We have to look at injustice where we see it, and we have to take it on.
Well, you know, I got to tell you, Suzanne, you know, great work. I saw some of the images. I hope folks will go to rememberthetrianglefire.org. We'll get links on social media. You can take a look at the website. You know, just incredible work on your end. Congratulations for getting this done. And I appreciate you taking a little time for us to share.
Thank you, Rick. I'm really glad you're paying attention to this.
No, this is really important, and I give you the utmost credit. I appreciate the time. Thank you so much, Suzanne. Again, this is another one of those things. I hope you'll take a look at it. Remember the triangle fire.org, the website. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. I'll take a quick break right back after this. Stick around. Listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1936. 50,000 people gathered in the small town of Mount Olive in southern Illinois. They had come to commemorate a new memorial to renowned labor leader Mother Jones and to honor mine workers who had lost their lives. 5 special trains and 25 Greyhound buses helped to bring the crowd to the Union Miners Cemetery. The cemetery was founded as a resting place for fallen miners. In 1898, in the town of Verdun, violence erupted. Remembered as the Verdun Massacre, 7 miners were shot dead at the hands of company hired guns. 4 of the murdered miners were from Mount Olive. The miners were originally laid to rest at the town's burial plot, but the owners of the cemetery objected to the ceremonies that the union held there. So, the local miners' union purchased land and moved 3 of their brothers to the new union cemetery. When Mother Jones died at the age of 100 in 1930, she asked to be buried with her boys at the cemetery. The miners raised more than $16,000 for a monument. The 22-foot-tall obelisk is made of 80 tons of pink Minnesota granite. On the obelisk is a medallion bearing the likeness of Mother Jones. She is guarded on either side by a larger-than-life bronze statue of a coal miner with his sledge. In 2015, a crowd of 300 gathered for a rededication of the monument. Illinois AFL-CIO and the United Mine Workers of America spearheaded the campaign to raise $100,000 to restore the site. One of those who attended the rededication was Bill Felica, a local retired miner. He told a reporter, "Mother Jones is like a local hero. She wasn't afraid to stand up to the big shots like judges and politicians. She was just a hellraiser." Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com. Back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out our website, thericksmithshow.com. I got to tell you, looking at the images of this monument in New York, I'm looking forward to getting back to the city to take a look at this. And as I said before, I've been to the Brown Building in the past, and if I remember, there had been a marker, commemorating that this was the site. There had been just a plaque on the side of the building. But this is something, much, much, much different, something much, much better. And look, at the end of the day, the hope is that the more we reclaim our history, especially labor's history, because, I go back to our labor history tour of 2013, where we wrote the book, Daddy, What's the Middle Class? In the places where we went, all across the country, where there was still allowed to be labor history, it had been sanitized. And one of the places, we went to Martinsburg, West Virginia, the site of the beginning of the Great Railroad Strike of 1877, was at this roundhouse in Martinsburg. At least this is where they say it. There's conflicting arguments happening in Baltimore, other places, but Martinsburg was pretty much the place where most people said that started. And we were told, there's a marker there. There's stuff there. We were told. So we went and we scoured the roundhouse. Nothing. All about how wonderful the roundhouse was. Talked about the fire. Didn't talk about, what happened. Talked about that there was a fire, it burned down, they rebuilt it. But not anything about labor, nothing. And, we the whole place. And as we were about ready to leave, you know, one of my kids said, "Hey, you know, there's something down at the end of this alley," and pointed to a, you know, a sign and at the end of the alley. So we walked down to the end of this alley, and there's a placard, and it's about the roundhouse. And I'm like, "Well, that's still about the roundhouse." I jump up on the guardrail. I look at the other side of it. On the other side of it, there was the placard that commemorated the Great Railroad Strike of 1877. So in order to read it, we had to go back, you know, walk the half a mile back into the roundhouse, go back in through the roundhouse, back jump off the platform, walk along the railroad track that, you know, just about a half a mile almost, and then look up 10 feet. And that is where the sanitized version, the corporate speak version of labor's history was found. And that should have been, you know, the telltale sign of what was to come. Because, unfortunately, this is what corporate America has gotten away with. And look, the moneyed interests have done a great job of ensuring that labor education never gets near our kids in school, that they never learn anything about the history of work or workers in this country. In fact, you know, I tell it all the time, you know, in school, the only thing that I ever learned about labor history was the Molly Maguires. And we were taught that they were criminals. Also taught that they didn't exist. So they were criminals, but they didn't exist. A whole bunch of stuff. Nothing about the ancient order of Hibernians. They were the Molly Maguires, and they were criminals. So much more complicated. And this is where, you know, as a labor person, as someone who has studied a bit of our history, it's a lot more complicated and a lot more bloody and violent. The path to a middle class, the path to prosperity that we take for granted today. You know, we take as a birthright almost. This good fortune we've been born into. It was brought to us because generations before us fought, bled, and died for it. You know, the regulations that we swear at now. The unions that people mock or degrade. That's what built a prosperous working class. You know, I hear people say, no, my hard work, I pulled myself up by my bootstraps. Nonsense. You go back and you read labor's history of people working, you know, 70 hours a week, sun up to sun down, 6 days a week, owing their life to the company store and never getting out of debt. And if we spent time remembering the past, which is why, you know, you listen to the right's attack on education, a big part of that, you know, the whole attack on CET or CRT or CTR, or, I don't know, it's a theory about race that's critical or something. The whole attack on that is about, we don't want to learn about history. You don't want to learn complicated, difficult history. We want jingoism. We want talking points. We want happy stuff. We were the good guys. We, you know, benevolence. We want, you know, rich guys who were benevolent. Andrew Carnegie was a good guy. He brought us libraries. Never mind all of the history around, you know, what he did to his workforce. Never mind any of that. Never mind him and Frick and the Homestead Strike and never mind any of that stuff. He funded libraries. So for me, this is part of when I see something like this monument, I see this as a victory for working people, because this is going to be an opportunity for people to live a bit of history, to go, hey, maybe question, why is this here? And I'll tell you, I don't think labor has done a good enough job of talking about its history. I don't think labor has done a good enough job of promoting what it took to build the most prosperous working class in history, what it took to fight for the 8-hour day, what it took to fight for minimum wage, for weekends, for vacations, for days off, for health care, for retirement security, for any of those things. I don't think they've done a good job at all in telling those stories. What we end up getting is the corporate speak. The benevolent corporation gives us these wonderful things out of the goodness of their hearts. It's amazing to me how many people think that even in union environments, that the wages, hours, and conditions that they get are because the company is good to them. Or that some invisible hand has created this environment. Some benevolent invisible hand, which I got to tell you, curious to me. So I think this is a good thing, and I'm looking forward to seeing the Triangle Memorial. I'm looking to see what I got to get there. It's one of those. It's now a pilgrimage thing. I'm going to have to make a specific trip just for this. I wish I would have known this was going on today. And because we would have made a trip out today. It's important stuff. Tomorrow, will we get a speaker? Is there a speaker to be had? There are some signs of positivity. Jordan has said he's out. He's going to throw his support behind whoever the nominee is going to be. I've seen that story. Is it true? Is it false? I don't know, but that's what the story is. Maybe we will get a speaker. Maybe we'll have the appearance of a functional government soon. Maybe. Want to hear your thoughts, though? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Miss any portion of the program? Grab the podcast. Share it with your friends, neighbors, coworkers, all that. Appreciate you being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. Rick@thericksmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.